It's Thursday, December 22nd, and I'm Nancy Cook, your host for this week. Here are the numbers that matter. 1 million, that's the amount of money that Donald Trump's campaign spent on private security contracting through the end of November. Roughly 65 million, that's the number of votes that Hillary Clinton received now that all 50 states are certified. 0, that's the number of Hispanics that Trump's recruited for the cabinet. And 26, the number of public relations execs that the Trump transition team has hired to get its cabinet picks through the confirmation process. Now grab your calculators and enjoy the Politico Nerdcast. It's our last Nerdcast of 2016. Thanks to our listeners for supporting us. And today we have joining us Shane Goldmacher.
Hello.
Ken Vogel.
Hey.
And Tara Palmieri.
Hello.
Now let's get to our first data point. Shane, you want to start us off?
We're starting off with 65,844,610, and that is the official certified number of votes that Hillary Clinton won, far more than Donald Trump, but not nearly enough to actually win. He was certified as the winner by the Electoral College this week. And I think the interesting thing about that number is how close it is to Barack Obama's number from 4 years ago. So there was all this talk that she didn't really turn out Democratic voters. They didn't come out in the same way they did for Obama. But actually, she got within 75,000 votes of Obama's total. The problem is she did in the wrong places and in the wrong states. She ran up the score in California, and she did terribly across the Midwest, falling far behind his pace in those states. And that's really the story of the election here. She won more votes in many places, but they were all the wrong spots.
And I think this really gets at the demand that we're hearing from some Democrats, a lot of Democrats, for a really in-depth autopsy report, kind of a shoe on the other foot from where we were 4 years ago when it was Republicans who were forced to go through the motions of doing this autopsy report. And the ironic thing about these autopsies are they're often like so far off base. The party like completely disregards them. You know, you look at the Republican autopsy after 2012, all about reaching out to Hispanics and even gays. And Donald Trump promptly crinkled up that playbook, threw it away, and won anyway. Democrats, though, are going to be forced to answer some similar sort of questions. And they may come up with the wrong answers, but about demographics. I mean, they were all about reaching out to the rising American electorate, they called it, of minorities and college-educated women and not working-class whites. And working-class whites were the ones who tipped the election for Donald Trump.
And the Clinton people have been anything but sort of self-reflective about that. I mean, they've blamed James Comey. They've blamed the Russians. They've blamed everybody but themselves in terms of their schedule.
Have they blamed Anthony Weiner yet?
I think second-tier blaming. I mean, but it's one of those things where it's like you wonder why are they not talking about why we never went to Wisconsin. They lost a state that they never campaigned in.
And these autopsy reports are often about just satisfying the donors. The donors are the ones who want to see, like, we are the ones who gave you the money. You spent it in this way that now, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, appears to have been totally wrong-headed. Tell us why. Tell us what you're going to do differently next time.
Well, it also doesn't necessarily seem like Trump is doing a ton of outreach to Democrats and people who didn't support him.
I mean, more than talk of a mandate, they're pretty excited to have control of the House and Senate. I mean, the number they're looking at is 52 in the Senate, which is they can lose up to 2 votes on any given thing and still push people through. They can push through their confirmations. They can push through legislation. They can ram through on reconciliation in the Senate. Pretty much anything that cuts the budget. So they can put – that's how they're going to do the Obamacare issue early in January or February. So yes, I mean, Donald Trump clearly, if you follow his Twitter feed, is pretty self-conscious about not being declared a big enough winner, not being called a landslide winner, a mandate. But I think the people around him realize that the more important number is not his approval right now. It's the number of senators who are Republican are going to vote for him and for his agenda.
Well, that'll only last for how long, right? I mean, he only has that assurance. So he should be like stockpiling goodwill, right?
Well, we had a great story by Rachel Bade about how Republicans are fearful of being seen as crossing him or being insufficiently supportive of him because they're concerned that either he will lash them on Twitter, and that will lead to a sort of tsunami of criticism from his followers and their constituents, or some of his allies, including Breitbart News, will go after Republicans who are seen as not supporting his agenda items, and we already have seen a little bit of that. So that's very much the stick approach to sort of coaxing your own party to be supportive of your agenda. What's interesting is the lack, to me, of the carrot approach, you know, and I think some of that is because the party, which is the ones that would give, that use the carrots used to be things like earmarks or support, you know, from the party campaign committees for a tough reelect. Those are much less significant in the age of super PACs and no earmarks and Donald Trump's Twitter feed. How long the party unity lasts is a very open question, because it sort of seems to be more based on fear to some extent than on actual wholehearted support of Trump.
My data points are 0, the number of Hispanics appointed to Trump's cabinet, and 57 million, the number of Hispanics in the United States. So clearly the number of appointees in the cabinet do not actually meet or reflect the actual population of the United States. Trump recently met with Jovita Carranza, and his press team notably said that she was a candidate for the U.S. trade rep position, which they don't normally do that on their phone calls. They don't normally say that this person is a candidate. So they were really trying to make the point that he is meeting with Hispanics. She was the head of his Hispanic council. And so it'll be interesting to see if she ends up getting the pick. But from the people that I spoke to in Trump world, you know, he doesn't want to be pressured into choosing a post based on the ethnicity, filling a quota. That's his thing. He's always said that he's not going to be the most politically correct president. But there has been pressure, including from his pal Newt Gingrich and others, Bill Richardson, who have been for Trump, saying, you know, you really need to step up on this and show that you have a cabinet that reflects the diversity in our country, especially if he's going to take really tough lines on immigration. So we'll see what happens with that. You know, there's been some talk about who the next press secretary will be. And my sources have been telling me that Kimberly Guilfoyle, who's a Fox News presenter, she's half Puerto Rican, and that they are thinking of her as a better face for the organization, for the administration, over Sean Spicer. And it's because
better face than Sean Spicer? Come on now. He's a handsome man.
It's not, I'm not talking about the aesthetics necessarily, but some people might argue that. I'm talking about the fact that she's a woman, the fact that she is a Latino, and that when, you know, when Trump goes after, you know, certain topics that are going to be more contentious, especially on immigration and even on any sort of like women's rights issues, it'll the abortion stuff, it might be easier to communicate that from a woman, whereas it might be not taken the same way from a white man.
I find it really interesting that there's any discussion about we need to have a Hispanic cabinet member, we need to have like Latino representation, mm-hmm. because they so ignored that during the campaign, purposefully and intentionally. Mm-hmm. And you're right, they did go out of their way to point out that, look, this woman is coming in and she's Latina and we're interviewing her for this particular cabinet position, which is something they don't do at all.
Right.
But on the campaign, they do as like a head fake when they're trying to make someone feel good and bring them along, like they did with like Mitt Romney or like David Urban, as our, you know, the potential of David Urban being tapped as RNC
chair. They certainly do
chair.
Float, yeah. But on the campaign trail, like, there was the only modern campaign since 2000 not to have a website in Spanish. There was no Spanish translation of the Trump website. Mm-hmm. And this is purposeful. It's not that hard to translate your website. There wasn't that much copy on the Trump website. There wasn't deep sections. They made a conscious choice not to do it. And the fact that they're looking at this and thinking about it at all in terms of perception, it really interests me, just because that is a shift in their thinking from, you know, the politically correct incorrectness throughout the campaign.
But do you think it's a shift just because there's been negative headlines about it and the Trump people are sort of reacting to that? Or do you think that there's a genuine concern among the top circle of advisors that, you know, they need more diversity?
There's just, the camp is split, obviously, as we've been reading in many, many reports. So there are some within the camp that do think that, you know, he should go towards a more traditional route and have diversity within the cabinet. And there are some that say, just stick to what you were doing. So it's always, you know, there are different opinions, but yeah, there is certain groups are calling for a more traditional presidency and others are saying, let's do it your way.
If he wanted to have a cabinet that looked like his coalition of voters, he'd have very few billionaires. He'd have a lot of like white working class folks, maybe white working class men. But obviously I think this is one way in which the conventions, while he has flouted many of them, they still apply, and there's still people around him who come from more traditional, you know, Republican backgrounds who want to see him adhere to some of these things. And I mean, the funny thing is he talked to these Republicans, including Republicans who work for other candidates in the primary, or Republicans who were like totally never Trump, and they actually are like quite pleased by his cabinet. They think his cabinet looks like a traditional Republican cabinet in a lot of ways. I was talking with a very senior former Mitt Romney 2012 person yesterday who was like, you know, joking about it. He's like, Andy Putzer is the Department of Labor secretary. We used to see Andy all the time. Andy was one of our main bundlers. I was like, Andy used to come around all the time. It's like the cabinet is looking like, you know, looking like the Boston campaign headquarters of Romney.
Shane, you've been following sort of the West Wing appointments. How many of them have really come from Trump's campaign? Like, how much is he rewarding those people that worked with him in the trenches?
Well, right now, the most interesting thing is how few jobs he's actually filled. You know, the three top positions he filled today, one of them was Kellyanne Conway coming in as counselor. But you have Bannon, chief strategist, and Reince Priebus. And then a lot of sort of empty space. Steve Miller has been named as his top senior policy advisor. But so many other positions, the deputy chiefs of staff, which they've been teasing for 2 weeks, is coming within 72 hours or days. And there is a lot of angst from people on the campaign who have not gotten those jobs yet. The people were with him from the very beginning. One frame that people put on it that was really interesting is a test. You know, do RNC state directors get jobs before Trump state directors? Do the people who ran the RNC campaign in XYZ state get a job before the Trump director? Because the Trump director put their neck out there early, right? They were with Trump when everyone hated Trump. The RNC person, they were working for him when he was the nominee. And that's a test that a lot of those folks are paying attention to.
It's also, as you start to think, like, Priebus has a really, really strong hand in a lot of this, and you're seeing that. And it's kind of making me think, well, why? Right?
And yeah, absolutely. And the Trump people are resentful, frankly, of the way that Priebus has swept in. I mean, Priebus, you know, I think he played his cards pretty well. I think he, you know, as Trump called him, even during the most, tempestuous times of the primary, he was Switzerland. He tried to stay out of it. He tried to stay neutral. And that was hard with Trump because Trump was really, causing problems with the entire Republican Party. That said, I mean, he was definitely in all the RNC people who are playing major, major roles in the transition and are expected to get those jobs. Sean Spicer, we talked about, expected to be press secretary. Katie Walsh, who was Reince's number two at the RNC, expected to play a major, major role. Reince, obviously, is chief of staff. The RNC chair pick, the person who Trump wants to be the RNC chair, Rona Romney McDaniel, that is a 100% Reince Priebus pick. And so Reince Priebus has been sort of carrying the day in a lot of these things. And I think a very telling development that a lot of, when Alex Eisenstadt and I wrote a story about this, a lot of the people who proudly call themselves the Trump originals, they feel really anxious and they feel like they're not getting their calls returned. And one of the things that they were watching very, very carefully is what happened to Corey Lewandowski, the first campaign manager who brought so many of these folks in. Openly jockeying for a top job.
All right, Ken, I hate to interrupt, but no, we
you
actually...
Don't. You don't hate to interrupt me, Shane. You revel at the
just,
chance.
Okay, I revel at the chance to interrupt you, Ken, because we have breaking news. The Trump people just actually made some new announcements. They just appointed Sean Spicer as the press secretary, Hope Hicks as assistant to the president and director of strategic communications, Jason Miller as assistant to the president and director of communications, and Dan Scavino as assistant to the president and director of social media. Sean also has assistant to the president in his title. That is a lot of new assistants, but does include two originals.
Yeah.
Hope and Dan were there from the very beginning, and two latecomers, Sean from the RNC and Jason, who joined, I believe, in June, was Ted Cruz's communications guy throughout the primary, and after he dropped out, joined Team Trump.
So sort of a mixed bag there in terms of the dynamic that we were talking about, the Trump originals versus the people who they see as sort of Johnny-come-latelys. But certainly the fact that Hope got such a lofty position there, a big title, and so did Dan Scavino. I think that could potentially assuage some of the nerves of these Trump originals, but probably not totally, given that you know, their leader, Corey, didn't manage to break through.
I want to turn to Tara for a second, because you just got back from some time in Florida where you spent some time at Mar-a-Lago. You went to an off-the-record cocktail party with President-elect Trump. What was that like? What's Mar-a-Lago like these days?
Well, I noticed that it was really quiet, actually. I mean, I was assuming that maybe it's because it's the week before Christmas and people haven't actually left yet. But even when I wasn't that close to Mar-a-Lago when I was on pool duty, but I only saw about 3 kids in the pool. It just seemed very quiet. And then, you know, I could see President-elect Trump from time to time walking along the balcony. Sometimes I would see Hope Hicks, his new assistant, and I would see Reince Priebus from time to time, but the truth is that it really was dead. The fact that I could see those 3 people walking around the balcony in the main area means that there really weren't that many people there. Also, I mean, it's a beautiful property. I mean, to me, it looked a bit tacky because I'd been living in Europe and, you know, I'd actually seen real Versailles, not this.
Burn! Do not tell Donald J. Trump.
Well,
next, you're going to criticize Sheldon Adelson's Venetian hotel and say that it's not authentic.
It's no
Italy.
Venice.
Yeah.
Well, it's not, and I've stayed there before.
But they do have all suites, though, which is nice, especially when you're on the Politico expense account. You can get a full suite for, like, in the 200s. That's pretty
well,
good.
It is true. They do have all suites. But and the other good thing about it is that in Venice, the water can be quite smelly when it's hot out. But in the Venetian Tower, it's not. So, but, you know, taste aside, the tuna tartare was fine. No, it was fine. It was good. We didn't really know what was going on. All we were told was get some decent clothing. You know, we're going to have an off-the-record event with top staffers. We were not told that the president-elect would be showing up. And then it was sort of like a surprise. Here he is. He came down. I can't really go into much more than that because it was an off-the-record event. We took some flack for it afterwards, but I also noted that there was someone from literally every single outlet, every major outlet. And, you know, people were trying to get there from all over. And so the same people who were being really critical the next day were people who just couldn't get on a flight to make it there, which I find to be quite interesting. Also, you know, I guess we could talk a little bit as well, if you want, about the fact that there hasn't been a press conference with the president. And how long has it been now?
A while, and that's
since
sort of
the
underlying beef that I think drove some of the criticism. Mm-hmm. Is like, here's a president who hasn't really, president-elect, who hasn't really made himself available in the traditional forums, you know, to the press en masse that we've seen from some past presidents-elect, and yet he's having this off-the-record confab. And you know, we talked a little bit about how it's a tough calculus for us as journalists to make when our choices are zero access or off-the-record access. And I think it's especially tough when you're not even, like, you don't even have, like, the chance to sit down and actually think it through. You're literally, like, sitting there doing off-the-record with staff, which we should point out is a very common phenomenon. And then all of a sudden the principal, in this case the president-elect, shows up. I think you would be very hard-pressed as a journalist to turn your back on that and say, if this is not on the record, then I am not going to participate. And then even more hard-pressed to leave if the answer is no, it's going to be off the record. So I think a lot of the criticism maybe misses that sort of perspective.
Well, I also just think it's interesting that this is how, Trump decided to finally interact with reporters. I mean, I was at that rally in Alabama Saturday. Like, 30 minutes of the hour-long speech were about bashing the media. You know, he's blacklisted a bunch of reporters over the campaign from Politico and a bunch of other outlets. And so it's interesting now that there would be this off-the-record cocktail party.
I got the impression that they're really trying to, like, turn over a new leaf and just, like, show that they do want to have some sort of relationship with the press. It's also, like, I don't know if they were paying attention to the fact that Obama recently had his, White House press
Christmas year-end press conference.
No, not even the press conference, but also the party.
Oh, right.
You know, all these people are posting pictures with Obama, and it seemed that, like, that was what Trump wanted to do as well.
Like an official, almost incoming White House party.
Like, he wanted to have his own party in a way. And I think, you know, they're realizing now that there are certain things that you have to do to get by. You know what I'm saying? Like, so maybe he thinks he has to engage with the press. I mean, he wasn't hostile with us by any means.
Yeah, what was the tone like? I'm curious about that.
I mean, he was a lot of the things that we had already heard from him. It was, you know, a lot of kind of shooting from the hip about a lot of different topics, from international issues to domestic.
And this is his MO, though, right? Is he bashes people from afar and he smiles at them and shakes their hand and hugs them from up close. He goes to the New York Times
for the cameras.
He goes to the New York Times in their editorial board meeting and says, "You guys do great work." You know, he bashes, bashes CNN, but he has a perfectly good relationship.
He told the Times, like, "My goal would be to be able to come back here in 4 years and have you guys say I did a great job." I mean, that's not even just unique to his relationships with the press. Like, you say nice things about Donald Trump, he says nice things about you. Whether you're Vladimir Putin, whether you're President Obama, or whether you're the New York Times editorial board. So my data point is 1,045,870. That is how many dollars Donald Trump's campaign spent on private security contracting through the end of November, which is the period covered by the most recent FEC reports. Now, that's nearly three times as much as Hillary Clinton's campaign spent on private security over the course of the whole campaign. And Trump has continued spending on this private security even after Election Day. It's gone towards sort of this private protection and intelligence force that he's used to supplement the personal protection that he received from the Secret Service as a candidate and as president-elect, when you get an even more robust Secret Service contingent. And as we reported earlier in the week, Trump is going to continue employing at least some of these folks after he's sworn in. Now, that's a totally unprecedented measure for a president-elect, and certainly for a president. The Secret Service is seen as really the gold standard of protection, certainly personal protection. And traditionally what we've seen is presidential candidates, certainly presidents, when they do rallies that are political rallies, they have local law enforcement who are the ones who are doing the sort of crowd control at those rallies. Trump maintaining his private security force, the reason why it's so key that he's doing it is these folks can basically throw out anyone for any reason as long as it's a private event and not a presidential, not a government-funded event. So Trump is going to continue to do these rallies, he suggested, as president, and we understand they're going to be paid for by some kind of private outside group using private funds, either campaign funds or contributions to a nonprofit. That allows them to continue to pay these private security folks and allows these private security folks to continue to throw out whoever they want. I mean, you could literally be wearing like a Barack Obama shirt and they'll be like, "Sorry, that's grounds to be removed." Obviously, the Secret Service or local police would be a lot more careful about throwing someone out for a perceived expression of First Amendment.
I was at the Trump rally in Mobile, Alabama on Saturday, and I knew that Ken's story was coming, and I saw three Trump private security guards there. And actually, they were on my flight out of Mobile the next morning with a big plane load of Secret Service people. And I'm sort of curious, Ken, you know, your article did really talk about the tension between Secret Service and these private security guards. Apart from just the protesters, like, what's the implication for protecting the president?
Yeah, there's a couple of things that the Secret Service folks who we talked to were concerned about. First is liability. I mean, if the Secret Service is at an event, even if it's a privately funded event, a campaign event or an event funded by Donald Trump's outside group that's going to push his agenda, his organizing for action, if you will, then if something goes amiss and there's a problem and there's a lawsuit, even if the Secret Service are not involved, even if it's Trump's private security who are the ones who precipitate the action that causes the lawsuit, the Secret Service folks who I talked to were pretty well convinced that the Secret Service would be roped into it. They would be the ones who would be seen as the deepest pockets by a potential plaintiff. So they would be named in a lawsuit. They would be the ones who would be dragged before Congress to testify about how things went down and why things went wrong. And then the other thing that they're concerned about, and this is the issue that I think most of our listeners and most Americans should be most concerned about, is that like these private security guys, even if they're veterans of the New York City Police Force, even if they're retired FBI agents, they are just simply not trained like Secret Service folks are trained to handle all the various types of situations, threats that might arise in an event with the protectee, in this case, the president-elect, the president of the United States.
There's confusing lines of authority too, right? Like the Secret Service is one responsibility, which is the safety of the principal. They're not responsible for crowd control. If there's a problem in the crowd that's unrelated to the safety of the principal, they generally don't respond. That's what they leave the local police to do. And so what exactly is this Trump security force? What is their job? Are they there for Trump? Because if they're jumping up on stage, like that's getting in the way of the Secret Service, which you actually mentioned in that story, one instance where that happened with Keith Schiller. Are they, you know, policing the crowd on his behalf? And then, you know, are they working for the government? Are they not working for the government? Yeah, there's all kinds of questions.
It raises some very interesting questions that I understand that members of Congress, since my story ran, I've heard from several members of Congress on oversight committees that have jurisdiction over the Secret Service who have suggested this is something that they'll look into. And it does raise this sort of uncomfortable specter that Trump has his private security force. You know, several commenters on Twitter after the story ran were talking about like his Revolutionary Guard. All dictators have their private police. And I'm not willing to go that far, but it certainly raises these questions. And if I may just elaborate on the incident that Shane flagged that we reported in the story, it was at a rally in March in Dayton, Ohio, where a protester jumped the barricades and rushed towards the stage. And you see, there's a video, and you see these Secret Service agents just like instantaneously swarming the dude, jumping on the dude. And at the same time, you have these two Secret Service agents whose job it is to like protect Trump, protect the protectee, and they swarm to him and they instantly form like a human wall around him so that like, you know, God forbid if someone took a shot, it would hit the Secret Service agent and not Trump. And like a split second later, Trump's longtime private security director, this guy by the name of Keith Schiller, former New York City police detective, he runs out and he sort of positions himself between the scrum where the protester is on the ground and Trump, who's being protected by these Secret Service agents. And, you know, if you look at that with the naked eye, you're like, well, that looks pretty coordinated. A bunch of like, you know, badass, like big dudes in dark suits with earpieces doing like acting all at once. But when I talked to these Secret Service agents, they said, no, in fact, Schiller reacted in the wrong way. He came from the direction on the stage to which the Secret Service agents would have evacuated Trump were they to deem it necessary to get him the hell out of there. They would have smacked right into Schiller. So it might have looked good, but the Secret Service agents are like, this is the type of thing that we need to avoid.
Well, also, I think it just speaks to a larger point that Trump is really not doing anything according to standard protocol.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is the bigger so what here. As you look at like the ways in which Trump has sort of come into the presidency, and he is flouting these conventions at every turn. And these conventions are, it's not just like protocol. It's like they're there for a reason. Now we're talking about like intelligence. When he said, you know, when he dismissed the CIA's finding that Russia had meddled in the election and meddled in the election with the goal of electing Trump or helping Trump. Now, there's no evidence that what Russia did was definitive, as I've said many times, including on this podcast, much to the chagrin of Hillary supporters who have written me each and every time. But there should be no dispute that what the CIA found isn't, you know, that the president of the United States should accept that. And he didn't accept that. That raises questions about how he'll interact.
When you talk about intelligence, there's a presidential daily brief. It's got the word daily in it. And Sean Spicer on their daily phone call said he receives the daily brief three times a week last week. I mean, this is, you know, they answered it this week that he spoke with Obama and he got the brief after the attacks in Germany and after the shooting in Turkey. But they have not said whether he received the intelligence brief those days.
So my number would be 26, and that's the number of these media Sherpas that the Trump transition team has hired to help get its cabinet picks through the confirmation process. And basically, you know, they were late to start on this, but they really have developed this whole infrastructure in the last just few weeks to really kick off the confirmation hearings that are going to start in January. They have this war room that's set up to basically combat negative press for all these different cabinet picks that Trump has made. They have policy people to help school these cabinet picks and the policies and how federal agencies work. They have these media Sherpas to help, you know, basically push back against negative headlines and media train some of these people, a lot of whom have no experience in Washington. And really, I think that that's where the story is going to shift to in January, the confirmation hearings on Capitol Hill and just how that all goes down and who's vulnerable and who the Democrats choose to pick off.
And there's really such a marked contrast from the campaign, if it works out. I mean, we haven't, you know, we haven't really seen it in action, this plan, so we don't know if these people are going to be really effective at rapid response and pushing back on negative stories, or, you know, working the Congress, to working key members to make sure that their questions are answered and that they feel good about the nominations. But just compare it to the campaign when there was no rapid response. I mean, that, you know, if you remember, like, during the primary debates in particular, when, you know, it was a crowded field and you would be getting like all these emails during the debate from like Rubio's people and Jeb's people, mm-hmm. and like Trump would just be solid. He'd be up there like kicking their butts in the debate stage, but he didn't have the reinforcements. And even during the general election, you know, there were times at which like they would let some of these bad stories go, or they wouldn't respond to them, or they wouldn't get out front. So seeing them at least trying to enact some kind of plan and some kind of infrastructure for, you know, doing this in a governing context, I think is a little bit of what Tara was talking about, which is like learning lessons and adapting to the way things work in Washington.
Well, they did make some early screw-ups that I think sort of helped, you know, make them do this. For instance, you know, Steve Mnuchin, after he was picked for Treasury Secretary, went on CNBC the next day and like made a bunch of promises. You know, one of Ben Carson's closest aides before he was named the head of HUD basically said that, you know, oh, Mr. Carson is a surgeon, but he doesn't think he's qualified to run a federal agency, which you can just see immediately coming up at the confirmation hearings. And so I think that they learn from those mistakes. And you're right, Ken, we have to see if any of this ends up mattering and if it ends up working, and also just how it ends up being coordinated with Trump's top staff, because there's so many layers. But I think that they seem to at least be trying.
Well, these Sherpa teams seem like they have two goals. Like for Ben Carson, it's pretty unlikely that the Republican-controlled Senate is going to torpedo Ben Carson's nomination. But he could be embarrassed through these hearings, and they need to help prepare him because he does not have a career of experience in housing policy. He has almost no experience in housing policy, and the Democrats are going to grill him on those specifics. And there are others like Jeff Sessions who could face both the potential for embarrassment and perhaps some risks. Tillerson particularly, it faces actual potential for risk in terms of Republicans not voting for him. So,
there's like a real coordinated communication campaign going on right now. Even for Sessions, they put up a website. They have a PR team working on that. They're working the Congress every day, and the Senate, I mean, every day. So, you know, they're ready for it. They're preparing.
Although I think like the bigger risk is, as Shane was suggesting, Tillerson, you know, you have three pivotal Republican senators who have already come out and expressed reservations. Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, both of whom ran against Donald Trump during the primary, and John McCain. Now, you know, Rubio, you know, obviously he's an ambitious fellow, and maybe he's looking down the road.
Rubio is ambitious?
I know, right? And maybe he's looking at his future in the Republican Party, but, like, good luck. I mean, I think, like, John McCain is going to be a major wild card throughout this Congress, through the next 6 years. Almost certainly not going to run again, you know, at various points, was indeed a maverick, as much as Democrats like to suggest that was all an act. No, he definitely like bucked his party big time on things like campaign finance reform, immigration reform, you know, cap and trade. He freaking like advocated for cap and trade, you know? And like, I think we could see the return of that John McCain in a way that could be a real problem for Donald Trump, not just on Rex Tillerson, but on Russia generally and on some of these other issues.
Well, one of the things I think is interesting as I've been talking to people just about this story is that, you know, they have this totally different approach for each nominee, and they kind of have to because, you know, some of them, like Sessions, has a little bit of, you know, he's been a senator for years, but then others of them, a bunch of them, have zero government experience. And so they don't really have a strategy for all the nominees. It's like kind of looking at the weaknesses of each one and figuring it out. And I think that that also just speaks to a larger question about how they're going to govern. I think that each cabinet head is going to kind of be left to do his or her own thing. And you can even see that playing out with how they're approaching the confirmation hearings.
I mean, some of these nominees have their own constituencies who are rallying support for them, especially the conservatives. So like Scott Pruitt, who Democrats very much would like to target as the head of the EPA, has a bunch of conservative Republicans rallying Republican support for him. And guess what? That's all he needs. He only needs partisan Republican votes. So, you know, Pruitt, as much as Democrats are going to hem and haw over his record and what he did in Oklahoma, the fact that there's conservative Republicans rallying for him makes a big difference compared to a Steve Mnuchin or some of these other picks who have given tons of money to Democrats.
Well, the other thing that I think could really trip up these nominees is just that the Trump people did so little vetting of them. Like they, you know, met people and then 4 or 5 days later picked them. And so committees like the Senate Finance Committee that's filled with these tax experts are now going through the tax returns of Steve Mnuchin and Representative Tom Price. And, you know, the Democrats on that committee are going through those tax returns, too. And they may find things that the Trump team didn't uncover. And that could be true all across the committees because they did no vetting. And I think that will be a major surprise if these things come out.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's like, that's sort of Washington 101. These folks, I mean, the Democrats complained during the Obama transition that the Republican, I think it was the Republican staff, the Senate Finance Committee, maybe, they had these detailees from the IRS. These are like civil servants whose like whole jobs have been based around like, you know, taxes and going through tax returns. And they were in there like up in those tax returns doing like forensic audits that really tripped up a number of nominees. Some who withdrew, some who took some serious hits and made it through, like Tim Geithner, TurboTax Tim Geithner, who screwed up his own taxes while he's up for Treasury Secretary. So I think we will see some stories. And the interesting thing is the Trump folks were saying, I mean, at one point someone said, like, we trust, like, the media to be our vetters. The media, you guys are doing a great job looking through these things. I'm like, what about you? Aren't you supposed to do it, you know?
Yeah, so I think they've left a lot of that to chance, and there will be potential problems there.
Good for us.
That's it for us. Goodbye, Tara. Goodbye, Ken.
Fun time as always.
Goodbye, Shane.
Forever.
Thank you to our producer, Bridget Mulcahy, our illustrator, Bill Kookman, and most importantly, thank you to our listeners. We'll be back with our next show in the new year on January 5th. Talk to you then.